Hello, everyone. I'm Ronnie McBrayer, and I thank you for finding my podcast. Here you will find my regular talks, the occasional interview, hopefully a little light from the Enneagram time to time, and hear conversations with friends on the ever-changing, ever-evolving nature of faith. If you are burned out on religion, to quote Eugene Peterson's marvelous paraphrase, but your faith is still important to you, or if you consider yourself a spiritual exile with no real place of belief to call home, then I have you especially in mind, and I hope you'll stick around.
I wasn't especially close to my paternal grandfather, but here he is, Mr. Fred McBrayer, with my grandmother Bonnie. I loved him, but it was a matter of distance and presence. I simply wasn't around him all that much. Not like I was my maternal grandmother, who will forever be the most influential person on my life. I knew her, really knew her. My father's father, however, I never got to the marrow of the man. He remains a mystery in some ways. That doesn't mean that I didn't know some things about him. Number one, he loved music, and he taught me my first chords on a guitar. He had a stunning tenor singing voice, and he traveled all over North Georgia as president of the Murray County Singing Convention. That was shape note singing in the camp meeting gospel tradition. He loved history and family ancestry long before the internet made genealogy research so much easier. He was a Freemason in the Scottish Rite Order. He was always sharply dressed, always. He wore a tie almost every day, in a tight, full Windsor knot, suspenders, polished shoes, wingtips to be exact. One pair was two-toned leather. A fedora always hung on a nail by the phone on the wall, there so that when he answered a call and he had to go, I think he could easily snap it onto his head. He loved crumbling cornbread into buttermilk at supper time, and he had a bowl of Cheerios right before he went to bed every night. I know he suffered and he lost much over his life, though he never talked about it. He chose to tell stories. He chose to sing and laugh instead, and he had the absolute best laugh you would ever hear. And my guess is that Fred McBrayer was always tired on Easter Sunday. That was one of our regular visits, to go see the folks on Easter afternoon. He was always as sharply dressed as ever, quick to answer the ringing phone as if drawing a revolver in a gunfight. He wouldn't let it ring more than once. Always had a tale to tell, but he was just a little less spunky on Easter afternoon because he had already been to church three times. A sunrise service, to be sure, to the Corinth Baptist Church, in whose cemetery he and all my kin now lie, and then to the Casey Springs United Methodist Church. He was loyal to both because he led the music in both places. And at one point in time, he had a son pastoring in each of those locations simultaneously, one a Baptist and the other a Methodist. I guess he was tired because he had been hosting his family, his children, his grandchildren, cousins, neighbors, all coming over after a massive feast. And it was because of Good Friday and Holy Saturday that he was so tired. For all his music leading and gospel singing, it wasn't because he had been at church during Holy Week. Now, that might be a common practice if you're Catholic or Lutheran, but if you're Baptist or Methodist in the Georgia Hills, nobody had even heard of Maundy Thursday or Good Friday services. You just didn't go. So what my grandfather did every Good Friday, rain or shine, 40 degrees or 80 degrees, he laid off the rows for his three-acre garden. My maternal grandmother would do nothing of the sort unless the farmer's almanac approved it and the stars and the planets were in their proper constellation order. But my grandfather paid no mind to such things. Yes, he had disked the field a couple of times during the winter to turn the soil up to the rain, but now his old rusty tractor bellowed and he took to the fields in preparation to plant all that Silver Queen corn and runner beans and okra and field peas and squash into the ground. And the next day, on Holy Saturday, he did just that. Seed by seed, one by one, row by row, a cotton sower's bag around his neck, and a shovel in his hand to cover each individual kernel over 3 acres of freshly plowed ground. I don't know if he reflected much on the crucifixion and resurrection of Jesus on Easter weekend, but I know he worked really hard in his garden on Easter weekend. Now, by the time I came of age to really observe all of this, he certainly didn't have to work that hard. Lord, there was running water and electricity. And a man could drive 20 minutes to town and have all the fruits and vegetables that he could buy. But there was a habit in that particular generation, a habit born out of necessity, when growing your own food was not a hobby, it was a requirement. That generation and those before, that generation was connected to the land. They understood soil and weather and seasons. That whole generation had dirt under their fingernails because they knew the dirt was precious. The annual planting of the seed was a sacrament, not because it fell on Good Friday, but because it was simply holy. The waiting that followed was a spiritual discipline. Reaping what would eventually come was a grace. People used to know that their gardens were life itself. I think we have forgotten that. I was at a county commission meeting decades ago. Love to tell this story. And a homeowners association had shown up to pick a fight with a local farmer. Now, I lived in the upper reaches of north of Atlanta, and suburbia was booming. And this may be a familiar story to some of you, that people would buy land that used to be farmland and build a 5,000 square foot McMansion on it instead. And so there was a whole neighborhood that had built in this valley that once before had only been agriculture. And they were calling the farmer to task because his cows were loud. And his tractor got mud and whatever, God knows what, on the streets. And then the biggest complaint of all, his chicken house smelled like a chicken house. And the lady speaking for the HOA got up and gave her case before the county fathers. And then the farmer was allowed to speak, and the farmer got up and pleaded his case and then turned to the lady that represented the HOA and said, "Ma'am, if you had it your way, where would you buy, where would you get your beef and your chicken?" And she jumped up to the microphone, and I kid you not, she said, "Well, sir, I would just buy mine at the grocery store." Clueless about where the actual food comes from. And maybe we are clueless about what is exactly maybe at our grocery store. Not much is fresh from the farm anymore, is it? A few generations ago, less than 5% of our food was processed. Today, more than 60% of our food is processed. Preservatives, GMO alterations, industrial farming, these have made food production incredibly efficient. Yields are 75% greater per acre of land today than they were 100 years ago. And yet, the U.S. diet is trash. And is absolutely the worst diet in the developed world. We don't eat from a garden or a farm. We eat from a box. We eat out of a microwave or what is handed to us through a drive-thru window. And I'm no organic eating saint. I'm guilty as charged. We don't have dirt under our fingernails. That's high fructose corn syrup that's under our fingernails. We are disconnected from what actually gives us life. And what is true physically can be true spiritually and holistically. Return to the origin story of the Hebrew people. Humanity is planted in a garden along with all he and she will need to thrive. Animal life, plant life, springs of water, abundance for all, and most importantly, in this sanctuary, communion and connection with God, with the Maker of all things. That's the Hebrew concept of beginning, of how things were, of how things could be. But it goes wrong. Their story is our story. Through the choices we make, greed, pride, and fear that awakens within us, we do damage to ourselves, to our surroundings, and to others. We become alienated from our roots, our place, and our God. Milton's classic poem is a treatise on the subject, Paradise Lost. And it's a theme picked up far and wide throughout all literature, all religions, all psychology, anthropology, and spirituality. There is a deep estrangement, a longing within the human spirit for what once was, for simplicity, for union, for harmony, for peace. Robert Frost, the great American poet, wrote this: God made a beauteous garden with lovely flowers strewn, but one straight, narrow pathway that was not overgrown. And to this beauteous garden he brought mankind to live and said, to you, my children, these lovely flowers I give. Prune ye my vines and fig trees. With care my flowerets tend, but keep the pathway open. Your home is at the end. And that homelessness is what we so often feel. Eternity is set in our hearts, the Jewish poet wrote, but it feels inaccessible, overgrown, hard to find. But John Milton's classic poem aside, paradise is not lost forever. It's an interesting word, by the way, paradise. It's only used three times in the entire Bible, most conspicuously by Jesus as he hung on the cross. One of the insurrectionists crucified with him turns to him and has a deathbed conversion and offers a final prayer. When you come into your kingdom, Lord, remember me. And Jesus said to him, I tell you the truth, today you will be with me, and the strangest word choice, in paradise. It is not a Hebrew word. It is a Persian word, a Babylonian word, that was picked up from the Babylonians and adapted into the Hebrew culture because it was such a beautiful word. It means, you might guess, garden. Specifically, Eden's garden. So when Jesus turns to him and says, today you will be with me in paradise, he is saying, you will be with me in that beautiful, lush enclave, that retreat from all these troubles. We'll be back in the garden together. So leap with me to the Hebrew view of the end. It's Christian for certain, but all the early Christians were Jewish. It's the account from Revelation that Anna read. The parallels are inescapable. It's a massive, lush, fruitful garden, just as in the beginning. A river runs through it with water as clear as crystal. There's not a tree of life, there are trees of life, bearing fruit, healing the nations. All curses are gone. Nature and creation have been washed clean. Alienation and estrangement with each other and with God have been forever reversed. God's light fills the universe. This is the end of the world. This is the last word. Eden reclaimed and restored. And I know you were looking for the four horsemen of the apocalypse and Armageddon. No, that is not the last word. Humanity is once again rooted in the garden of God, not just like things were when they began, but better and more incredible than ever. Now, is it a metaphor, a symbol of what we cannot put into words? I think so, but that doesn't mean it isn't true. It's simply indescribable and utterly beautiful. Paradise found. All misfortune reversed. Hatred washed away. Sins all forgiven. Estrangements all reconciled. Heartbreaks all mended. Those separated forever reunited. All darkness vanquished by the light. All death made alive. Now, you may say that I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. I have fallen into the habit of quoting Fyodor Dostoevsky at Easter, the great Russian writer. I instructed my wife this week, when my passing is had, not only what I read at the end of last week's sermon, but make sure this is said at some point over my ashes. I believe this with all of my heart. Dostoevsky said, "Pain and suffering are inevitable. But I believe, like a child, that all suffering will be healed and made up for. That all the humiliating absurdity of human contradictions will vanish like a pitiful mirage. That in the world's finale, at the moment of eternal harmony, something so precious will come to pass that it will suffice for all hearts. It will comfort all resentments, atone for all crimes, make up for all the blood that has been shed, and make it possible to forgive all that has happened." Between these two gardens, one lost and one found, there is a third one. John 19. Following Jewish burial custom, they wrapped Jesus' body with spices and long sheets and of linen cloth. The place of crucifixion was near a garden where there was a new tomb never used before. And so because it was the day of preparation for the Jewish Passover, and since the tomb was close at hand, they laid Jesus there. And then if we leap from that first Good Friday to the first Easter, out of that garden, out of that springtime garden, Jesus is resurrected. Mary Magdalene is the first person to encounter him, and she is confused and dazed by the events that have transpired that morning. From John 20, we read, Jesus asked Mary, "Why are you crying? Who are you looking for?" I love this line. She thought he was the gardener and said, "Sir, if you have taken his body away, please tell me so that I can go and get him." There's a lot of theories as to why Mary did not recognize Jesus that morning. I won't get into those. I'll just go with what I think is most simple and most obvious. She thought Jesus was the gardener because he looked like a gardener. And you would too. If you had just crawled out from the dust of the grave, if you had just pushed yourself free from the tomb, you might have had grass stains on your knees and dirt under your fingernails and dust still covering your head, your hands, your feet. She thought him to be the gardener because he looked like a man working in the garden. And actually, yes, he is the man working in the garden, restoring the garden of life. And that's an image that we don't quickly recognize, but once you see it, you will never forget it. Let me share with you quickly classic Renaissance pieces, each one capturing Jesus as the gardener. Beginning in your upper left-hand corner, Sandro Botticelli has Jesus in that walled enclave, that place of paradise. Moving to your right, from the National Library of the Netherlands, Jesus has a shovel stuck in the sand. And third, of course, a masterpiece by Rembrandt. A black and white by Albert Dürer, shovel over the shoulder. Lavina Fontana's oil print, a straw hat and a shovel. An anonymous German print that is ink and wash on paper. It's almost cowboy Jesus. The hat is his halo, if you look really closely at it, and he has a shovel in his hand. And a final print from the National Library of Wales, Jesus encountering Mary Magdalene in the garden, chewing on a piece of straw as any good gardener would. Renaissance painters are not the only ones to capture this scene. If we move to contemporary renderings, at the upper left, again, stained glass from Trinity Church, New York, there is that ever-present shovel. Indian artist Yoita Sahi, his interpretation from 2010, my favorite. Jesus has taken away the scythe from the grim reaper and is now using it as a gardening implement. Polish artist Władysław Kohut, Jesus the Good Gardener, uses a Byzantine Jesus who is wearing overalls with his name stitched on the front in Polish, cultivating a flower pot that is the world. An oil print from Graham Sutherland, 1961, Jesus is an urban gardener heading to his rooftop greenhouse. Jean-Peter Malwick also has Jesus wearing overalls, standing in front of the tree of life that is a blooming dogwood tree. And finally, He Kwai's distinct Chinese oil painting from 2013, the shovel oh so suddenly, subtly held in Jesus' hand. A garden is where it all began, a garden is where it is all heading, and a garden is what makes it all possible. The resurrection is heaven come to earth, life and life-giving spirit confronting and overcoming death. This gardener does all that is necessary and possible for life to flourish. If we go back to Frost, he has kept the pathway open and our home is at the end. It's a tough assignment to join Jesus in this work, because we live in a world with an insatiable appetite for death, consumption, and destruction. We seem to live in a desert of hatefulness, injustice, greed, when it seems that all that is thriving these days is what kills, steals, and destroys, be it the natural resources and beauty around us that we devour as if they will always be replenished, the unrelenting nature of our wars, the viciousness of our disagreements, the weaponization of our words, the way we rip away at our opponents, the complete disregard for civility, honesty, and good old-fashioned neighborliness. It's hard to find anything worthy to grow in this climate. It's hard for what is tender and good and right, no matter how promising, to keep from getting trampled. But if Easter teaches us anything, it teaches us that it is never too late for hope, and it is never too late for life. Get out there. Lather up in your sunblock and your bug spray. Get your hands in the earth. Don't be afraid of a little dirt under your fingernails. Being a people of the resurrection doesn't mean we have bought a long-term end-of-life insurance policy that only pays if we die. It means that true life has come to the world today. We are its ambassadors. We are its practitioners. We are its cultivators. We plant, we incubate the seeds of life and love, joy and peace, patience and kindness, goodness and faithfulness, with the hope of resurrecting power. So, let us be good gardeners. Seed by seed, one by one, row by row, a sower's bag around our necks and a shovel in our hands, following the example of our Lord who came to make all things.